Well, good morning. Today we're going to be beginning a new series. In the fall of last year, we spent a lot of time in the book of Acts in the New Testament looking at the expansion of the church. And in these sort of cold and wintry months, we're going to be looking at a man in the Old Testament who's just vibrant and filled with life and energy. And we're going to look at the life of Elijah. And so as a way in this morning, I want to begin with a recent story, a fairly recent story, about somebody else who knew God closer to our time, and then we'll use that as a way back to Elijah. In 2002, the Time End of the Year Persons of the Year issue had three women on the cover. There was Sharon Watkins, who wrote a letter to the CEO of Enron opposing the accounting practices of Enron. And then there was Colleen Rowley, who pleaded with the director of the FBI to investigate a man who later turned out to be one of the 9/11 bombers. And the third person who made the cover of Time because of her similar active stance in her job to bring important things to light, there's a woman named Cynthia Cooper, who is a Christian. She went to the board at WorldCom to inform them that the company had hidden millions of dollars in losses. And at that time, it was the largest corporate fraud case in the history of the country, and it was a very big risk for her to go to the WorldCom leadership, the CFO, and confront them with this dishonest practice. And Richard Lacayo writes in Time about Cynthia Cooper, about the three women, with these words. He says, "Their lives may not have been at stake, but Watkins, Rowley, and Cooper put pretty much everything else, other than their lives, everything else was on the line. Their jobs, their health, their privacy, their sanity, they risked all of them," and here's the key part, "to bring us badly needed word of trouble inside crucial institutions." There was trouble, and the world needed to know. WorldCom needed to know. Enron needed to know. The nation needed to know that the FBI had already been told about 9/11 and hadn't followed through. And these women took stands that were very courageous, and their health and their friendships, their jobs, in very serious ways, they were taking great risks. Martin Luther King summed up, I think, the key thought, the key lesson we learned from those three women's lives in these words. He said, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter." And these three women decided there's something that matters, and we're not going to be quiet about it. Well, when organizations or nations go astray, the culture needs truth tellers who will stand up and say, this is the right way to go. So now I want us to turn back to the first story of Elijah that we're going to see in 1 Kings 17. It's on the outline that you would have received when you came in this morning, that text. So let's stand out of respect for God's word, turning to 1 Kings 17. Please follow as I read. "Now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, 'As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word.' Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, 'Leave here, turn eastward and hide in the Kereth Ravine east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I've ordered the ravens to feed you there.' So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kereth Ravine east of the Jordan, and he stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook." This is God's word. Let's pray. Father, in these short verses, you tell us much about who you are and how you interact with our world. I just claim the promise of Jesus. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. Would you please take your word now and make it alive by the Spirit. Bring it into our hearts in the places where we need it. Challenge us and encourage us with what a great and powerful and good God you are. In Jesus' name, amen. Please be seated. Let's just look at this story. This is a short passage, a short way into the life of Elijah, just these six verses. But there's a lot of activity going on behind these six verses that we need to know. In the 8th and 9th century before Jesus came, there was great falsehood and spiritual decay in Israel. Elijah, whom we'll speak about today, and Elisha, we'll be talking about him also in the next few weeks, both of them were prophets in the 8th and 9th centuries B.C. And much of their stories takes place against the background of a king named Ahab and his infamous wife, Jezebel. Her name is still famous. She was such a dark woman in spiritual and moral ways. But anyway, Elijah and Elisha ministered in the time of Ahab and Jezebel. Before their time, Israel had been at risk of spiritual decay. It happened ever since God sent Moses down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments, and the first commandment was, "You shall have no other gods before me," and the second commandment was, "You shall not make any idols that represent me or any other god." And so from the very beginning, when the first commandments came down at Mount Sinai, it was not long after the commandments were delivered by Moses that Aaron was making a golden calf and the people were worshiping it, and there were riotous parties and celebration at the foot of Mount Sinai. But even though there had been risk from the beginning, all of a sudden in the reign of Ahab and Jezebel, things turned very much to the worse. Many of you will remember we spoke about David last year, that he was a great king. And in the kings of Israel, there was first Saul, and then David, and then David's son Solomon, who was so wise. And then Solomon had a son named Rehoboam. And Rehoboam was arrogant, and because of his arrogance, the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes of Israel in the north, split apart from Judah, and the kingdom was divided. And it's in the northern kingdom of Israel that we find out about Ahab and Jezebel. And what happened was that Ahab's father, Omri, decided to make a commercial and a political alliance with the king of Tyre in the north. For business reasons and political reasons, he wanted to tie Israel to Tyre. And so he said, "My son Ahab will marry your daughter Jezebel, and things will go well." And so that was what happened. Omri pledged his son, and the marriage took place, and Jezebel came down from Tyre to Samaria, and coming, she brought with her 450 priests of Baal and 400 priests of Asherah. And Asherah was the female consort who was tied to Baal. So with this development, things began to get very much worse in Israel. Beginning under Ahab and Jezebel, but going on actually for several decades, what happened was that there was religious war between the dynasty of Omri and Ahab and the kings that followed them. There was war between the royal family and the many people who lived in Israel who said, "We're not going to make this change. We were the people who were brought into existence by the God of Israel, by Yahweh, and we're going to be faithful to Yahweh, and we don't care how many false prophets you bring down from the north and how many bulls you make to worship," because Baal was worshipped in the form of a large bull. They said, "We're not going to go that way." So there was war, because the royal family was saying, a lot because of Jezebel, the princess from the north, who is now the queen of Israel, a lot of the royal family and the people connected with the family were saying, "We're going to worship Baal." And Jezebel said, "We're going to extinguish the worship of Yahweh in Israel." But the common people said, "No, we don't want to do that. We want to stay faithful to Yahweh." Well, what kind of God was Baal? Why did it matter so much whether the people followed Baal or not? Some of you may be wondering, why would anybody bow down to a bull anyway? And I had a slide. There's technical difficulties this morning, so the slides aren't here. But in any case, the people would literally bow down to a bull, to a figure of the false god Baal. And you might think, why would anybody do that? But if you think about it for just a minute, you'll realize that we have the same kinds of things going on today. One scholar, and this is in your outline if you want the fill-in, one scholar says, an idol is a finite thing. It's a limited, created thing. An idol is a finite thing or value worshipped and adored and seen as something necessary to find joy in life. It's not necessarily bad in itself. But if you think, I have to have that, I must have that, I won't have joy or meaning in life unless I have that, that's become an idol for you. If you were just to imagine the bull that the ancient Israelites were beginning to worship and write on it, instead of Baal, write higher education or dream house or cars I've always wanted or expensive vacation or cosmetic surgery. In the United States, we spend $13 billion a year on cosmetic surgery. No other nation in the world spends even $1 billion. We spend $13 billion. Cosmetic surgery or the right clothes. You'll realize that people are worshiping false gods every day right around you. This is very common. This is very close. Now these things, the vacation, the car, the house, education, these things aren't necessarily wrong. The question is, do you have to have it? Can you not find joy in this world unless you have it? Yesterday I was at a high school function here in town where there were many parents. And most of the parents that were around me at the time have children in college. And we were talking about our children. One of the things that struck me as they were talking about where their children were, and one parent said, well, my son is going to be getting a job after he graduates with his bachelor's and wants to save up some money so that he can go to grad school. And another woman sort of said, well, you're not going to pay for grad school? Sort of a little sting. And the man said, his face sort of fell, and he said, no, he's going to need to get a job. But here's my point. People are very conscious of how much money is going out, even if you've spent the tens of thousands of dollars it takes to help somebody get a bachelor's in this country today. There are many people that don't stop there. Pour out another 100,000 to pay for a master's or a PhD or whatever it is they're going for. Point is that parents and children in our culture will sacrifice enormous amounts of time and money and family harmony to make sure that their children get the most prestigious education they can possibly acquire. And again, I'm not saying that education or houses or clothes are bad. I'm just saying that if you have to have it, if you can't be happy without it, there's something wrong. You've crossed a line spiritually. And it's just the kind of line that was happening in the 9th century BC as the Israelites were worshiping Baal. You see, Baal, you need to understand that Baal, in their eyes, he was a nature god. His primary function was to control the fertility of the ground and also the weather. In an agricultural economy, and really all of our economies at root are agricultural, it's just that we have far fewer people today who need to be involved in agricultural because our technology of farming is so good. I heard a speaker say yesterday that we can afford now, because our technology is so amazing, that about 2% of the population of the world is involved in farming. But all of us are eating every day the food that they produce. In any case, whether that statistic is accurate or not, I don't know. But what I do know is every society depends on food. And so Baal was the god of the storm. He's often pictured with a lightning bolt, and his voice was said to be the thunder. And Baal, the theory goes, Baal's the one who gives rain. If you didn't worship Baal, if you didn't bow down to Baal, the rain was just not going to come. And when we know that these agricultural people were depending on rain every day in order for their crops to grow so that they could eat and also sell some of the crops, we see why they were so prone to be dependent on this bull. If we don't understand about the connection between Baal and the rain, we won't in any way understand why this great clash came between Elijah and Elisha and the prophets of Baal. Well, God actually saw these developments taking place, saw Jezebel coming down and all of the hundreds of prophets of Baal and Asherah coming with her into his people, into Israel, and God was concerned. And he began to take steps to demonstrate that he is God and that Baal was absolutely nothing. So we move from, first of all, the backstory and the problem of Baal to the idea that a jealous God sends Elijah. God in his jealousy, actually, sends Elijah. We need to realize that God's jealousy is, in fact, a good thing. One of my seminary classmates wrote a book. He's a man who travels around the world, actually speaking to people about why belief in God is a good thing. And in one of his books, the title of the book is God a Moral Monster? He's answering the question, why is it that people, why is it that God is jealous? Why does he so eagerly yearn for the loyalty of his people? And he has these words in the book. A wife who does not get jealous or angry when another woman is flirting with her husband is not really committed to her marriage. Outrage, pain, anguish, these are appropriate responses to violation of the marriage vows. And then, since God so often applies the marriage bond as an image of his bond with his people, Paul Copen goes on to write, God isn't some abstract entity or impersonal principle. We should actually be amazed and feel a sense of privilege that the Creator of the universe is so deeply connected with us, human beings, that he would open himself up to sorrow and anguish in the face of our rejection and betrayal. Imagine that. The God who made galaxies and planets, that God bothers to reduce himself to being in pain about whether you are loyal to him or not. It's amazing condescension. So God, in his goodness, begins to take steps to address the Baal worship. Long ago in Genesis, Deuteronomy, God had said, prosperity comes from me, rain comes from me, crops come from me. Deuteronomy 32 says that the sky, if you obey me, I will give you rain. But if you disobey me, the sky over your head will turn to bronze, the ground beneath you to iron. The Lord will turn the rain of your country into dust and powder. God told Israel in the beginning, he tells us today, obey me, things go well. Disobey me, there will certainly be trouble and conflict. So all of a sudden, here comes Elijah in verse 1. Now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, no backstory, no comments about his family, no words about his education, but we do get some hints. He says, again in verse 1, Elijah comes to this king who's married the northern princess who brought idolatry in. Elijah says, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, as surely as that God lives, whom I serve, and not only does he live, but I serve that God, as surely as that Lord lives and as I serve him, there's not going to be either dew or rain in Israel unless I say so. Now that could not have been a clearer casting of the gauntlet. Baal is God of the rain. When Baal is depicted, he's got the thunderbolt of lightning, and the thunder is his word, and rain comes from him. Interestingly, something else that is helpful to know is that in Jezreel, in the area where Elijah has this confrontation with Ahab, every morning from fall to spring in the valley of Jezreel, the coating of dew is so heavy that even if it didn't rain in Jezreel, there's so much dew that agriculture would still be possible. It's in the area of Jezreel that someone else famous in the Bible, Gideon, put out his fleece at night, and that fleece or the ground around it was covered with dew in the morning. It's an area where there's heavy dew. So Elijah says to Ahab, let's make it clear. As the Lord lives, and as I serve that Lord, there's not going to be rain. There's not even going to be dew unless I say so. This is a very clear challenge. So Ahab doesn't say much, and Elijah just comes into the presence of the king. He tells him that, but we still get some hints about what kind of man Elijah is, even though we don't know much about his family. He's a loner. One of the things we'll see is in the next few weeks as we study Elijah, there are all different kinds of personality types that serve God. Elisha is much more sensitive and people-oriented. Elijah is a bit more strident and confrontational, but both of them served God and had a huge influence. But one of the things about Elijah, he just comes straight into the presence of the king. He brings no one with him, but he comes on the strength of his relationship with God. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, here's the message. We get a hint about what kind of man he is in verse 2 and verse 5, because it says, then the word of the Lord came to Elijah in verse 2. And verse 5 it says, so he did what the Lord told him. Elijah's a man who was schooled by God in private. There's an old saying that God is never going to use a person in public until that person has learned to honor God in private. And what strengthened Elijah to come into the presence of the king was that he had built a life, years and years, of obeying God closely in his personal life. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve. Literally, the Hebrew says, before whom I stand. And there are many nuances of the phrase in Hebrew, before whom I stand. On the one hand, there's a volitional part. I've chosen to stand in front of this God. There's also a fixedness. I stand, I remain. I'm committed, and because I stand before this God, He makes me strong, He gives me success. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, before whom I stand. Elijah's preparation for ministry is just like yours. When Chris talked about the elders coming around to visit and to talk to you all about all the elders will be involved and talking to members of the congregation about the relationship with God, what's that about? That's about all of us being prepared to have ministries. Some of you will be homemakers and minister in the setting of your home and your children and so on. Some of you will be ministering in medicine or in education or business. All of us have a ministry that God calls us to, and we all prepare for that ministry as we personally, individually walk with God on our own. That's how it all begins. So here's the conflict and the confrontation. There's a king from the region of Tyre who wrote a song to Baal, and the song went like this. The heavens rain oil, the wadis run with honey, that's wadis or streams. So I know, the king said, that the mighty one, Baal, lives. Did you hear that? The heavens are going to rain oil and good things. The wadis are going to run. Because the wadis are running with water, there's going to be honey and agricultural benefit. And because of the prosperity that Baal brings, I know that Baal lives. So here it is. There's the challenge. Elijah comes and says, no rain, no dew, unless I say so. So how do things work out? That leads to the third and last part of the story. As God uses his servant, he prepares him and provides for him. You know, as many of you know, that as you've begun to, or you have been, some of you for many years, whether you've been doing this for many years or just a few, you know that as you begin to obey and serve God, all your problems don't disappear. Cynthia Cooper, who after WorldCom fell apart, became a celebrity. She wrote a book about being honest in the business world. She's now she travels around the world as a speaker. But she was invited to speak at the business school at the University of Texas in Austin. And as she was speaking at the University of Texas, a man in the audience at the business school said to her, hey, did you feel a lot of pressure when you took your stand against the CFO at WorldCom? Kind of a silly question, but he asked it, and this was her answer. She said, I knew that my job was in danger. There was a lot of pressure. My hands were shaking every day. My heart was pounding. What happened with her was that she found out on her computer that there was a major section of the company's computer files hidden from most people, where it seemed as though a lot of dishonest transactions were being recorded. And when she talked to her boss about it, he said he threatened her with dismissal. And so she went in at night. She moved all of her personal things out of her office in case she was immediately fired. And she and a small team of people who worked with her began to investigate this dishonesty at WorldCom. And as she was doing that, she says, I knew my job was in danger. My hands were shaking every day. My heart was pounding. My physical health declined. I lost weight. I cried often. And She says, I remember my father standing at the foot of my bed reading the 23rd Psalm over and over and over. The Lord's my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. So for Cynthia Cooper, she had made a stand. She decided to be obedient to God. She decided to be honest and do what's right. And as she did all her troubles disappear? No. Her troubles became worse. Her health declined. Her fear for her job increased. Many things went in a difficult way for her. And in the same way, as Elijah began to obey God, and God says, you have to go to Ahab and confront him. Elijah goes to confront the king, and then God says, by the way, go hide in the area of this little stream in the valley, and as you hide there, I'm going to feed you, birds are going to bring you food, and this little stream is going to provide you water. Well, what did Elijah just told Ahab? He told him no rain, no dew even. Well, what's going to provide water for that brook? Obviously, rain. And so God's telling him, you go, and you're going to get water from this brook. And as Elijah stays there day after day, week after week, and there's no rain, what happens to that brook? It gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And Elijah could not help but be thinking, is this a very good idea? This seems a little bit unreliable, God, because you've told me to come here, and this stream is going to take care of me. We're going to see next week that stream completely disappears. And the birds, ravens, are not known to be especially friendly to humans. It's an amazing miracle. I can't imagine what it's been like the first day that the raven food arrived. He's probably sitting on a rock or looking up at the sky, and the birds come in, and it probably wasn't dim sum or Rafferty's buffet, but he was getting something pretty regularly out of the sky. And as that began to arrive, he must have thought, this is really amazing. This is really something. But even as the ravens kept coming, the stream got smaller and smaller and smaller. And there was stress. But the main point, we'll see more about chapter 2 and what God did about that next week, but the main point is, as Elijah began to obey, God increased the stress. There was more tension, and there was reason for Elijah to be a bit concerned. Now, Elijah was obeying God, and he fulfilled exactly what Israel should have been. Elijah was obeying and trusting God, and God provided him for him day after day after day. God does provide for those who obey and follow Him. This whole time by the brook, and what we're going to see next week, we're going to see that Elijah is going to go straight up to the region of Tyre and Sidon, where Baal worship begins. And he's been hiding in a valley, but now he's going to go up and hide near Tyre. And actually, Ahab's going to send people up to Tyre, and where Zarephath, where Elijah is going to be staying, is so close to Tyre that he might have been able to look out the door of his house and see the messengers going from Ahab up to Tyre. God's going to tell him, "Oh, go hide now, right under the gaze of the king who sent all these false prophets down." God keeps making it hard. But notice in verse 3 what he says to him is, the word comes to Elijah and he says, "Leave here, turn eastward and hide." And he's first going to hide by the brook, and then he's going to hide up in the region of Tyre. But he's hiding. And there are 3.5 years that this is going to go on. But eventually, and we're going to see in chapter 18, verse 1, God's told him for 3.5 years, hide, hide, hide. In 18:1, he's going to say, show yourself to the king. And there's going to be an amazing confrontation we'll see in a couple of weeks. But the main point is, how did he get ready to show himself? By hiding. He obeyed. God was faithful. God took care of him. For us, it's the exact same way. As we start to obey God, we are going to have our faith stretched. We're going to sometimes think, Lord, how can this possibly work out? But as we do obey by faith, we begin to see over and over, in problem after problem, how God is faithful as we're living in obedience. Three lessons as we close. First, because God is my creator and my sustainer, I depend only on Him. Now that doesn't mean I don't set my alarm and go to work and work hard, but it means that my ultimate trust is not in my company. It's not in my 401k. It's not in my insurance plan. It's not in whatever I have in the bank. My trust ultimately and the major focus of my trust is in God. All we have, all we really need is from Him. This week, I'll say more the third part, but you will find over and over, we are just like the people who worship Baal. We'll find as Christians, there are some things that we think, it could be clothing, it could be a house, it could be cars, it could be vacations, it could be education, it could be many different things. But you'll find, if you're honest with yourself, do you find a tendency in your heart to say, if I can't have that, I can't really be happy. It could be a relationship, it could be a job. And there is that in us to say, I want that. And as soon as you say that, you've begun to depend not on God, but an idol. Water, food, clothes, wisdom to do our work well, counsel and relationships, those things God provides richly in abundance as we obey and seek Him. Second, because God is sovereign in the world, we obey Him and watch for His hand in the details. He's sovereign over the weather, as Israel was about to learn. He's sovereign over rain and snow, over birds, over His people. He told Elijah, go to Ahab. He told Elijah, go to the brook. He is sovereign over us. He has the right to say, go here, go there, and then we should follow Him. He's sovereign. That means He rules. He's in charge. He rules over us, and He rules over all kinds of little things. And because He rules over everything, we look for His hand in the details. Thirdly, because God is faithful, those who obey Him experience His love and provision. Elijah went off to that brook, and the water was there, and the food came. Cynthia Cooper knew that she needed to take a stand for honesty at WorldCom, and she did, and things went well. For you also, as you obey and follow, you will find that He will... His love and His provision will follow you. A small, short story of how I engaged a need in my life this week. I was, just because of the moving of the office that Chris mentioned earlier, I didn't take some vacation time at the end of last year that I had intended to take. And it got a little stressful, and in fact, there were some health issues that burst out in our family because... I think the doctor said because of lack of rest. And so, on Tuesday of this week, I said, God, I believe You for everything, and I've committed my life to following You, and now I'm coming to You and I'm saying, I really think that my wife and I need a vacation, and we need, the way we need water to drink and food to eat, these are things that I'm not asking for as luxuries. If You want to take me from Hillsboro in the south to Hillsboro in the north, I'm open. But I want to, it doesn't have to be fancy, it doesn't have to be far away, but I need this. I'm asking for it because I trust You and I've committed my life to You. Within 48 hours, I've been offered a mansion in the Bahamas and an apartment in Florida. Now, I grew up in the Bahamas, and to me, life in the Bahamas, that sounds good. This was a mansion that was built 2 years ago. It's brand new. It rents for $6,400 a week at this time of year. And we would have had it for ourselves, and I was offered it at a very, very big discount. And I could walk out, the man who owns this place said, what are the activities you could do at this place? And said, well, snorkeling, this is hard. He said, you walk out the door onto the deck, you walk down the steps, you walk a few feet to the water, you start snorkeling. Then they had a picture, 10 sailboats pulled up on the beach. And as I looked at that website and those pictures, there was a part of me that said, I want that. A part of me that said, I need that. And long story short, We're going to Florida. I just thought, Lord, thank You. Thank you for giving me the choice, but I think wisdom is the other way. Main point is, as you obey and follow Him, His love and His provision will follow you.